Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Cleaning the barn and passing the gavel. Hello again, I'm Oren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Today, Congress is likely to pass the first federal budget in 5 years. If the Senate agrees, the government will stay open and pay the bills till after the next election. For the most part, Democrats are happy to go along, but the right wing of the GOP calls the bipartisan deal surrender to President Obama. The likely new Speaker, Paul Ryan, won't have to deal with a default or a government shutdown, but that looks like a curse to conservative colleagues. We'll hear how a temporary return to business as usual is dramatizing the Republican Party's radical change. Today's talking point, black life in America and systemic racism. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. The bipartisan budget deal would keep the government open in paying its bills, but it's being denounced by the right wing of the Republican Party. We'll hear how business as usual has become a political liability. Today's talking point, it will take generations to end America's systemic racism if it can be ended at all. We'll hear more of Ta-Nehisi Coates' message to his teenage son. First, this news update, Dennis Hastert of Illinois was House Speaker, third in line for the presidency, from 1991 till 2007. That's longer than any other Republican has ever held that office. Today, Hastert pleaded guilty in federal court to a charge that could mean 6 months in prison. But many questions about the case have yet to be answered. Jason Meisner reports for the Chicago Tribune. Hi, Jason. Good to have you with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
What was the count that he pled guilty to?
He pled guilty to one count of structuring bank withdrawals. There was another count of lying to the FBI that's going to be dropped at sentencing.
Dropped at sentencing. Now, that's something of a key to knowing why he illegally withdrew the money.
Yeah, well, the allegations are, and he admitted in court, that he was withdrawing the money to pay off a person who's identified as Individual A to hide wrongdoing that Hastert committed against this person 30 years ago or so when he was a teacher in Yorkville, which is west of Chicago. And he admitted in his plea agreement that he did lie to the FBI, although he did not plead guilty to that count, but he did admit to those allegations.
So on the other hand, they have not specified, I take it, in official documents who he paid or why.
Correct. From the get-go, the identity of this person, this Individual A, has been a secret. And also, they have never said in court documents or in the allegations why he was paying Individual A all this money. He had agreed to pay a total of $3.5 million. So it's only through sources, federal sources, have told the Tribune and other media outlets that this was all to cover up sexual wrongdoing against one of his students when he was a teacher and wrestling coach at Yorkville High School.
So this would have been homosexual sexual behavior.
Correct. Individual A was a male student at the time.
So does it appear that the plea deal was made in such a way that information didn't have to become official?
Yeah. Well, he hired some very good attorneys, and the government, you know, they had the option, certainly, to try to work in, identify this person. There have been a lot of questions of why wasn't Individual A charged with extortion? Or exactly how is this deal reached? How are the payments being made? So none of that came out in this plea agreement. Now, the U.S. attorney in Chicago, Zachary Farden, did say in a statement that when Hastert is sentenced in February, more details could come out because at sentencing, of course, they get to argue the good and the bad attributes of the person being sentenced. And And he said in a statement that more could come out if it's relevant to the charges. We don't know exactly what he means by that, but we'll be waiting to see.
There also are pre-sentence investigations by the probation and parole office.
Right. Now that he's pled guilty, they dig into his past. They come up with a recommended sentence. They look at everything, financial history. Obviously, he has no criminal history that we know of, so it could be fairly straightforward. But they'll prepare that before sentencing. The report remains sealed, and then the both sides will be in court arguing before Judge Thomas Durkin why he deserves a certain sentence. We expect that Hastert's lawyers will argue that he deserves probation, no jail time. But prosecutors, the range that's in this pre-agreement goes up to 6 months behind bars.
So once again, his was Republican service in the Congress. He was there for a long time. He was Speaker for longer than any other Republican ever has been. Is there any precedent for this? Are there other speakers who've run afoul of the law?
Not like this, not with a felony conviction. You might remember Tom DeLay faced charges. He was the House Minority Leader, faced charges down in Texas, was convicted, but then those counts were overturned on appeal. So for a guy like Hastert, who was, you know, it's the third highest political office in the country, he was a powerhouse politician here in Illinois, and for him to be charged this way and to plead guilty to a felony is a big deal. And, of course, it just adds to the media circus that there's so many details that have yet to come out. People, you know, the media across the country launched this search for individual A, trying to track him down, trying to get him to comment. So far, no one has stepped forward. So we'll see what happens.
Is there a statute of limitation for sexual abuse against a child?
Yes, and also it would probably be a state charge anyways. But yeah, the statute of limitations on that, if it did occur, has long since run out. Of course, the the payments are much more recent. They started allegedly in 2010 and only ended when the FBI knocked on his door last December. So there are things that they could come up with to maybe charge if there was some kind of bribery or extortion going on. But you know, this plea agreement is pretty straightforward. All it is that he was illegally structuring these bank withdrawals to hide these payments.
All right. Again, sentencing expected in February. We'll see if anything more comes out then or between now and then. Jason Meisner with the Chicago Tribune. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
In a moment, cleaning the barn and passing the gavel on To the Point from PRI.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream, featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24. KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, and only back with To the Point, Republicans have a majority in the Congress, but passing the first federal budget in 5 years will require the votes of Democrats. That's expected to happen today because of a bipartisan deal that will keep the government open and avoid a default. That might sound like a good idea, but Republican candidates for president are on the warpath against it. Burgess Everett covers Congress for Politico. Hi, Burgess. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Warren. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so we have Ted Cruz calling this a golden parachute for President Obama and the House Speaker, who's going to resign on Friday, John Boehner.
Yeah, and you can expect most of the presidential candidates are going to share that view because in their calculation, anything that connects them to Washington is bad news. And for Cruz in particular, who has been very adept at using each of these crises and these pivot points on the budget, these dates, these deadlines to kind of elevate his fight with Republican leaders, he's going to lose a little bit of his toolbox with this budget agreement because it's going to be harder for him to kind of break through and make more of his conflict with Mitch McConnell and the House leadership.
Cruz, of course, is in the U.S. Senate. So are Marco Rubio and Rand Paul. None of them has even showed up to get the briefings on this bipartisan deal.
That's right. They weren't here on Monday night as the deal came together. They weren't here yesterday when Senate Republicans had a lunch devoted to the topic, and they're not here today. Obviously, they've got the debate in Colorado, and right now work is continuing on ironing things out. Crop insurance is the topic of the day today, as farm state Republicans have issues with the budget deal because of cuts to crop insurance. So they're definitely not only going to oppose it, they're really, really distancing themselves from it.
Obamacare, Medicare, Planned Parenthood, all kinds of things, the defense budget, all of those issues arise when you have a massive bill of this kind.
Yeah, that's totally true. And one thing to remember is this budget sets these parameters, but they still have to pass spending bills, and there's still going to be one due by December 11th. I think you won't see the same sort of shutdown threats you've seen in the past, but I think there will be more conflicts over this budget. The details are going to matter, and this is just a very broad instruction of here's how we want to spend our money for the next 2 years, but the specifics are going to be pretty painful as well, is my prediction.
Worth pointing out that one senator, Lindsey Graham, a Republican who's also running for president, says he'll vote for it.
Yeah, he was perhaps slightly less definitive than that, but he was saying enough nice things about it. And he had this private briefing with John McCain yesterday to talk about how they thought it affected the military. So, you know, this is in line with Lindsey Graham's brand, which is that he's kind of a centrist-leaning person on domestic issues, and he's a strong military hawk. And it's how he thought he was going to gain distance from Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, and Marco Rubio, and the only distance he's found is that he can't get on the debate stage with them.
He's going to be in the front row, in the first debate rather
right.
than in the second debate tonight. What about the military? That's something that Republicans are very concerned about, and this deal, as I understand it, does protect it from cuts.
Yeah, it gives a more half of the increase in spending, $40 billion over 2 years, and then a little bit more on this overseas contingency fund, which is always being kind of used by each party for its own priorities. So there's a decent amount of flexibility there if the president and the military request up to $16 billion more beyond the budget. Defense hawks can provide that to the military. So I feel like they were going into this thinking sequestration is bad for national security. So if we can do anything to write our budget more carefully and have our right defense priorities reflected in it, then it's worth doing. And so I think a lot of the Republicans that vote for this, it's probably going to be a minority of Republicans in both the House and Senate, they will do so because of the defense spending.
Okay. Now, this deal was worked out in private behind closed doors, and it may well be passed by the Congress before a lot of people hear this program. Also today on the agenda is the new speakership to be voted on by the Republicans. And once again, Paul Ryan is expected to win that. But he sort of insulated himself from this budget deal by saying he thinks the process stinks.
He did. And you know what? I was very surprised today. He put out a statement then saying that he would vote for it. So, you know, he's actually tying himself to it a little bit more closely than I think a lot of us did. The thought going into this was that he blasts the process, so he's going to vote against it, and he can't stop it, but he gets some distance from this Boehner deal, you know, this last hurrah for Speaker John Boehner, who lost so much support within the caucus. And I guess I'm not sure if it was a personal motivation that brought him around to say that he would vote for this deal, or if he really just believes this is the best way to deal with taking these fiscal crises off the table. But I think a lot of us expected him to maybe quietly vote no. Instead, he loudly criticized the process and said he was going to vote yes. So
probably can't vote quietly if you're the Speaker of the of the House.
It's all relative, Warren.
Okay, Burgess Everett again with Politico. Vin Weber is with us. He's a former congressman from Minnesota, now a partner at the Washington-based public affairs firm Mercury, and he's an advisor to Jeb Bush's campaign. He formerly advised Mitt Romney. Good to have you back on our show.
Great to be with you, Warren.
What about Mr. Ryan? Was it just too transparent if he said the process stinks and then voted against the bill? Does this, in fact, protect him in a way he won't have to deal if it passes with a government shutdown or a default?
Well, yeah, it's a good thing for Paul Ryan, who I know well and who used to work for me, actually, because he doesn't have to come into the speakership, and the first thing he does is deal with the notion of the debt ceiling vote and defaulting on our debt and all that. It's a good thing for him. He can get at least a little bit of a honeymoon as a new speaker, and he's going to need it because they've got a lot of other big issues that they're dealing with. His comments about the process stinking, though, I think was directed quite obviously at the Freedom Caucus and other members whose demands in this change of leadership struggle that we've been going through have been very process-oriented, less so on the substance of it, but more on the process. And so when Paul Ryan said the process stinks, that was music to the ears of the rebels who drove John Boehner out of office largely because they didn't think that he was including them in anything and giving them last-minute notice on big decisions, and that was that was the right move for Paul Ryan to make. But it would have been difficult for him to vote against it after his immediate predecessor, the Speaker, had negotiated the deal.
Wasn't Paul Ryan, though, involved in a very similar process with Patty Murray, a Democrat from Washington in the Senate, when the last major budget arrangement was agreed to?
Well, that's exactly right. Everybody's got a little bit of history on these things, and I think that was a great accomplishment for Paul Ryan. He showed that he could work across party lines. He showed that he helped avert a shutdown or default, and the outcome was basically good. But it is the sort of thing that the conservatives in the House of Representatives are most upset about, and they're upset about this deal. But they know that it's going to happen, and some of them are secretly not so unhappy that it's going to happen. They don't want to vote for the debt ceiling, but they certainly don't want the United States to default on its debt and the implications of that default be visited on the Republican Party.
Let me introduce Mickey Kaus. He's a political commentator, author of the book The End of Equality. He now blogs at Kaus Files. Good to have you on our show. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Warren.
You have indicated and pointed to the writings of others who have indicated that this is really disastrous and that it's a surrender to the Democrats. Why do you say that?
Well, the big weapon the Republicans had is this shutdown threat, and they got a lot of grief for pulling the government to the precipice of default. But they gave that up, and they didn't get very much in return. And they also busted the caps, the sequester that they had, were really the only effective thing they'd put in place to control government spending. And what they got was, well, some minor changes in the disability program. They're selling off the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. They're not the big, future-oriented entitlement changes that are going to put the government on a glide path to a balanced budget. A lot of them are just pure gimmicks, like they say, we won't have the sequester this year, but hey, we'll do it for two more years in the future. Of course, when the future comes, they won't do it then either. Then they'll put it off again into the future. So it's a lot of gimmickry. They didn't get much. It's probably a good thing that the threat of crisis goes away. I mean, I might even, if I were in Congress, I might even vote for it myself. But if you're a Republican, what's in this deal for you?
Well, what about these Republican candidates for president who apparently those in the Senate, except for Senator Graham, aren't going to vote for it and are in fact going to denounce it? Rand Paul says he will filibuster against it. What do they want in the future if they don't want to have a budget that allows the government to stay in business and avoids a default?
Well, I think they are hoping that they, and probably falsely and maybe insincerely hoping that they could leverage the threat of default into a big change. Like, a big change would be something like what Paul Ryan proposed with Social Security originally, private accounts, or changing Medicare to be something more like Obamacare with where you have to go out and buy a private policy. That would be a big change. And the sincere ones among them would say they want something like that.
So would that be a good thing, then, even if it requires threatening to shut down the government or not pay the bills?
Well, I can think of things that would be big and good and would be worth it. I favor ending entitlement spending on people who don't need it, on the rich, on the affluent. It'd be good to close a bunch of tax loopholes, like the carried interest loophole that lets hedge funders pay a lower rate. There are a lot of there are a lot of big things that you can imagine that would certainly be worth it.
So back to Vin Weber, you were in Congress. You've been an advisor to Mitt Romney and now to Jeb Bush, people who are thought to be in the so-called establishment part of the party. What about those elements of the party that want big change, and particularly those who are running for president? Are they taking over now?
Well, they're in the lead right now. I don't know if they're actually taking over, but there's certainly, as your previous guest pointed out, there certainly is no market in the Republican electorate for signing on to a deal cut in Washington that ends up spending more money than we were spending last year, and that's what this deal does. I think it does some good things. I think avoiding default is a very good thing. I think we need more money for defense. But there's no way that you're going to make that argument successfully, I don't think, to the Republican electorate out there. As to what they actually want, I mean, we know in this anti-establishment year they're unhappy with anybody that has anything to do with Washington. But the issues agenda that they're seeking is a little less defined. You know, you take Donald Trump, who's been the front runner since, you know, he got into the race in June or July. He has very few clear-cut conservative proposals out there. I mean, he gets people excited by bashing immigration quite unfairly, in my view, but be that as it may. But he doesn't have a lot of budgetary proposals or out there to try to define himself as the conservative candidate. He's just capitalizing on the fact that conservative and Republican activists at the grassroots are mad at anything that comes out of Washington.
Again, Vin Weber, former congressman from Minnesota. I just want to say thanks to Burgess Everett with Politico, who joined our program at the very outset. And I want to introduce James Fallows. He's a national correspondent at The Atlantic. James Fallows, good to have you back on our show. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much, Warren. Nice to talk to you.
What are we seeing here? It sounds, when we hear from Vin Weber, as if the Republicans and the Democrats are sort of working things out in the way that they always have. It sounds, when you hear from Mickey Kaus, as if something really different is being demanded by the right wing of the Republican Party. Is the party itself evolving into something different from what we've seen before?
Well, it does seem as if this latest agreement over the last couple of days is a different stage of the struggle we've seen for the last couple of years within the Republican Party, where, as Congressman Weber and also Mickey Kaus pointed out, there is a Republican presidential primary base, which is not a majority of the population, perhaps not even a majority of the party, which is insisting on really absolutist claims of one kind or another. On the other hand, I think the congressional Republicans, perhaps exemplified by outgoing Speaker Boehner, recognize that in the end, they need to do something to pass a budget and make the government work. That is a very hardline anti-anything governmental rhetoric is good on the primary campaign trail, but in the long run has not proven good for the party, even with these government shutdowns. So I think we've seen, engineered by Speaker Boehner in his last time, some backstage compromise to say, okay, we're not going to get the entire loaf, but let's pass a budget. Let's not have these brinksmanship exercises, which haven't gotten us what we wanted and have backfired politically.
Does President Obama profit from this politically?
I think he profits politically in the sense of, well, there's a tactical versus strategic thing. You could argue in the most callous sense that he has benefited from Republican brinksmanship through his administration, much as Hillary Clinton strangely benefited from the Benghazi committee hearing last week. But operationally, it's better for him, better for the government, better for international relations if we don't have this shutting down of government accounts. We get the, I may disagree with some of the other guests, get the Export-Import Bank going again, et cetera. So I think he profits both in the short term and longer term of being able to have the remainder of his administration be under normal operating principles.
Okay. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back and continue this conversation with our current guest, Vin Weber, James Fallows, Mickey Kaus. So we also may get an update on what the vote is looking like in the Congress as it begins to work its way forward on the budget and on the new speaker, Paul Ryan. On our talking point a bit later, Black Life in America and Systemic Racism. We'll hear more from Ta-Nehisi Coates. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive Angel Clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
We're only back with To the Point. You never want to predict anything for sure in politics, but we're talking today about the likely passage of a bipartisan budget in the Congress for the first time in 5 years and the likely election by the Republicans of Paul Ryan to be Speaker of the House, succeeding John Boehner, who negotiated the bipartisan budget deal and who is resigning from office on Friday. At the same time, of course, upcoming tonight is the next presidential debate with at least three of the U.S. senators who are running for office denouncing this budget deal, which is likely to be passed, one assumes at least, once again, by the Senate as well as the House. Vin Weber, I want to go back to you. Again, former congressman from Minnesota, advisor to Mitt Romney, and now to the Jeb Bush campaign. When the Congress was taken over by the Republicans, the leadership in both houses said, we're going to prove that we can govern. It appears, as we heard from Mickey Kaus, that their real effort to leverage change, however, comes from the threat to shut down the government and not pay the bills. How worried about that are you if, in fact, one of the so-called outsiders gets nominated to be president?
Well, it's of some concern to me, although if we actually had a Republican president, the imperative would be somewhat different. It is a hard fact that the power of the purse, which is what the Congress has, is largely restricted or even eliminated if they take off the table entirely the possibility of shutting down any part of the government. And President Obama has been able to take advantage of that in winning showdowns over this issue with the Republican Congress. But if you had a Republican president, you wouldn't have that problem because he would sign the bills with the Republican restrictions or reductions or amendments put on them. I think that the worry is how the Republican candidates for president will approach spending bills from now until the election of 2016, because they make life difficult for Republicans that want to make the government work. And as one of your previous guests pointed out, the fact that we've avoided default with this agreement does not mean we're at the end of brinksmanship. We still have to pass the appropriations bills that fund the government, and Republicans will still want to put conditions on them, whether it be restrictions on Planned Parenthood or repeal of Obamacare or what have you, and the president still won't like that. So the threat of a possible shutdown is still there, and you can bet that the Republican candidates for president, or at least most of them, are going to be laying down the law and demanding that Republican members of Congress not, quote, cave into Obama.
James Fallows, back to you, national correspondent at The Atlantic. Before Vin Weber needs to leave, which he does in a couple of minutes, you have written and you have said that we have now, to the discomfort of reporters old and young, a situation where the two structurally similar political parties don't exist anymore. One of them is really changing, converting itself into something else. What do you mean?
So what I mean is that in conventional journalism of days of yore, you would have a Republican and a Democratic governing party, each of which wanted to pass budgets, attend to various matters, and had different philosophies on the balance, the right way to do that. I think Congressman Weber was part of that branch of the Republican Party when he was in office. And I think he would recognize, too, that the cleavage within the Republican Party over the last, say, 5, 6, 10 years, however long, has been between those who think have a different view on how to do the business and who have an entirely different view in which they'd rather not do the business at all if they can't make these fundamental changes or have fundamental demands be met. And it's been difficult, among many difficulties that has caused, is in the media where we're used to saying, or quote one side and then the other and let the reader sort it out. It's harder for people in the media to say there is this new anti-governing faction and naming it as that.
Okay, Vin Weber, seconds remain until I know you need to leave us. How do you respond to what's happening, and are you worried about the future of your party?
Well, I'm somewhat worried, although I think things can change. But I think Jim Fallows has a pretty good description of what's going on. Too much of my party now has been defined and define themselves simply in terms of opposition to what Obama has done for the last 6.5 years. Now, let me say, you know, for one party to oppose the initiatives of another party's president is not unusual. It's not even necessarily wrong. But it's been at the expense of any kind of a governing vision for our party to replace what Obama has done or the vision that he has for his party. So I think that there's a concern, but normally you would say a presidential campaign is the solution to that problem, not the cause of that problem, and I'm not quite ready to give up yet. Let's see what happens in the debates tonight and in the campaigning over the next several months and see if a Republican governing vision that can rally our party and contest the Democrats emerges.
Finn Weber, again, former congressman and now advising the Jeb Bush campaign. Thanks so much for being on our show.
Always great to be with you, Warren.
Let me go back to Mickey Kaus, our political commentator, author of the book The End of Equality, who had said earlier that he feels the Republicans have given up something important by agreeing to, at least the mainstream Republicans, to this bipartisan deal rather than threatening to shut the government down. What about it? Is there a governing vision here or not?
Well, I disagree with Jim's analysis because it seems to me that there's sort of a game going on, which is, the Democrats wanted a national health system. The Republicans oppose it. You can't really expect the Republicans to roll over and say, okay, we got to be the governing party, so we're going to vote for that. And that what being the governing party in Jim's framework means is you have to then go about, Obamacare passed, we can't resist it anymore, we have to implement it better. And that's a really unfair expectation of a party that's, dedicated, opposed to what Obama is trying to do. We had an election, Obama won, we have Obamacare, that's fine. But you can't then expect the Republicans to just roll over and say, okay, now we're going to be good boys the way Republicans were after Lyndon Johnson passed Medicare. It's something. There's a reason why it took decades and decades to get a universal health system, and it's a big deal, and you can't expect it to be normal.
So, is there ever a time when you can concede a loss? Whether you concede you lost, and let's go on.
Well, at some point, and I think we're getting to that point with Obamacare, but you can't expect it right away, and you can't. I don't think you can dock the Republicans for partisanship points if it takes them a few cycles to come around. And they may win. Obamacare might stall out.
Okay, we've just been joined by Craig Gilbert. He is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been watching what's going on in the Congress as some of the things we've been talking about are developing. Craig Gilbert, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
What's going on?
Well, there's kind of a mob scene here in the Longworth House office building. The Republicans have been meeting behind closed doors, and the House GOP conference announced on Twitter that Paul Ryan has been nominated to be the next speaker. Reportedly, the vote was 200 votes for Ryan and 43 for Daniel Webster, and we should be hearing from members and the leadership soon.
What does that mean? Who are the 43?
Well, the House Freedom Caucus has 40 members, but clearly we know that some of them, and many of them, in fact, said they would support Ryan for speaker. There were other Republicans who opposed Ryan for a variety of reasons. Some of them just don't like his immigration stance. Some of them don't like the kind of deals he's made with Democrats to sort of keep the lights on and keep the government running. So he's starting out with the support of whatever that is, 80% of the Republican caucus, and we'll see where he goes from there.
Why is he unusual as a speaker? I believe, the youngest person ever to be taking that office.
He's the youngest since 1869. There's a lot of things that set him apart from past speakers. His youth. He's also the first speaker since, I believe, 1903, who went directly to the speakership from being a committee chair without ever serving in the House leadership in another leadership position. He'd be the most conservative lawmaker to be the speaker, arguably, since before World War II, if you believe the rating system that's used by political scientists to sort of score lawmakers ideologically. And he's also just the fact that he's been such a reluctant speaker sets him apart from anybody in memory.
So he makes Newt Gingrich look like a liberal?
Well, the whole party's moved to the right. So, his relative standing within the party may not be a whole lot different from Newt Gingrich, but you do have a more conservative Republican Party. Obviously, you have a much more polarized Congress. And I think, if you looked at their voting record on a whole bunch of issues, you would find Paul Ryan to the right of Newt Gingrich, even though he's not conservative enough for some members of the caucus.
Okay, Craig Gilbert, once again, Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We'll let you go back and cover this story as it develops further, and we'll find out, presumably, who, in fact, was it who voted against Paul Ryan and what that might mean for his future in that job. Thanks a lot for taking the time to join us.
Nice to be with you.
Let me go back to Mickey Kaus. What do you think about Paul Ryan, particularly his past support for immigration and the kind of deals that he now says stink?
Well, you know, I have let's say I'm a skeptic about the greatness of Paul Ryan. On immigration, he is a true blue believer in the free movement of people across borders, meaning he's for amnesty, he's for increased immigration levels. I just think that's a terrible thing for American workers. He's launched this big poverty initiative where he got a lot of good publicity for himself, where he went on a private poverty tour and only had one reporter who then told everybody about it. And his welfare plan seems more liberal than Newt Gingrich's. He's enamored of this David Cameron's idea of consolidating cash grants into one grant, so you get this dole, and the work requirement is really quite weak. On Social Security, he favored a very disruptive plan, on Medicare, which would require people to get new private plans when they're perfectly happy with government-run Medicare, and it wasn't very popular. So he's a guy who's come up with bold visions that I think are wrong, basically.
Let me go back to James Fallows. Where does Paul Ryan come down in terms of the divisions within the Republican Party from your standpoint?
So from the press standpoint, somebody outside the Republican Party, I think he's seen as trying to straddle the divide. Certainly he is the heir to John Boehner in terms of wanting to get things done as opposed to sort of Samson-like pulling down the pillars. On the other hand, the fact that he had to say he didn't like the process, he was against it, it was a way that he could sort of maintain his credibility with the Freedom Caucus, more of whose votes he apparently got than most people expected. So I think he's seen for the moment as somebody who has used another metaphor, one foot on each of the two horses that are pulling a Republican sled, and we'll see how long he can maintain that pose.
So his one possible fate, I take it, would be what happened to John Boehner, that he just couldn't run the show.
Yes. So it would seem that either the divisions within the Republican Party, the Republican Congressional Party now, are resolvable or they are not. And if they are resolvable, then perhaps Ryan, with his skills and with a sense that's good for the party, will be able to get people, at least for the rest of the Obama administration, to be pulling in the same direction. If they're not resolvable, then the same thing is going to happen to him that has happened to Speaker Boehner, and we'll see.
What about President Obama in this situation? Again, you said, I think, earlier that he somehow is making out better than he might have because, of course, the threats that might have existed are going away, at least to some extent. Is he going to have a more comfortable time, do you think, with Paul Ryan than he had with John Boehner?
I think that it's hard to say. I think he now knows that one thing that was a problem for him, even though a political crass advantage in the long run, which is these perpetual shutdowns, threats, he won't have to deal with that. It is possible that Paul Ryan will have more credibility with the right wing of the Republican congressional group, so he'll be able to do things that John Boehner wasn't able to do. I would imagine that the fundamental reality of President Obama's second term, which is that he can't get things done legislatively, so what he wants to do, he's pushed more and more to executive action. I think that reality is still there because it's still a Republican-controlled House. It's less disruptive in the sense of having constant shutdown threats, but he still is not going to get bills that he supports through the Congress.
Mickey Kaus, there have been reports that Paul Ryan has agreed, despite the fact that he is supportive of opening up the borders, not to take up immigration reform while President Obama is still in office. Do you think that he'll hold to that promise? And if so, will it make it easier for him to hold the caucus together?
Yes, I think he will hold to that promise, and it will make it easier for him to hold the caucus together. There's a more important promise, which is he promised to abide by the so-called Hastert rule, which will probably have to be renamed now that Hastert has pled guilty, but that says he won't move a bill without the majority of the Republican caucus behind it. And that promise extends beyond the end of Obama's term. So That is what has blocked immigration bills from coming to the floor of the House under Boehner. And if Ryan keeps to that promise, it's going to be much harder for him to bring in a so-called amnesty bill or immigration reform bill to the floor of the House. That's the big promise, and that's the one that people are skeptical that he will actually keep in the long run.
James Fallows, what are the consequences, do you think, if we don't come up with some sort of immigration reform before the end of the Obama presidency?
Well, I think it's unlikely that we will, partly for the reasons that Mickey says, and partly because so much of the Republican presidential campaign is being waged on this very issue. So it's very hard to see how the Congress could sort of resolve this underneath the feet of the candidates. One other thing about the Hastert rule, if I could, I think, you know, Mickey is right in that classically had meant most of the majority of the Republican caucus supporting a measure. Recently, it's become essentially there had to be unanimous Republican support. You can have the example of the Export-Import Bank, which a large number of Republicans voted for, when it went through today, but because it wasn't, almost unanimous, it had been blocked from coming up to a vote. So I think the Hastert rule has expanded, even as Mickey says, the name needs to change.
And as we heard earlier, of course, Dennis Hastert has pled guilty today to a felony. Do you agree, Jim Fallows, that with Mickey Kaus, that the name of the Hastert rule is going to have to be changed, and will the portraits come down in the Capitol Rotunda?
We haven't had quite this challenge before. There are checkered figures in American past. You know, we still talk about Aaron Burr, even though he shot Alexander Hamilton. But I imagine they'll find some way to give this a new name.
All right. Well, thank you all very much for being on our show today. James Fallows again, the national correspondent at The Atlantic. Mickey Kaus, political commentator, author of the book The End of Equality. Craig Gilbert, who took a moment from the situation in the House covering that for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel to tell us what's going on, and that Paul Ryan now has been elected by the Republicans as their nominee to be Speaker. And thanks to Vin Weber, advisor to the Jeb Bush campaign, and Burgess Everett, our earlier guest, a congressional correspondent for Politico. Yesterday, Ta-Nehisi Coates made the case for reparations to compensate for generations of racism in America. Today, he'll tell us about his own life and what he's telling his teenage son. Back in a moment with today's Talking Point.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney here with today's Talking Point. Ta-Nehisi Coates is back with us again, a national correspondent for The Atlantic. His latest book is called Between the World and Me. Ta-Nehisi Coates, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me back, Warren.
Your book is a letter to your son. And in it, you describe his reaction to some of the things that we have seen recently, particularly having to do with police behavior toward black people. Tell us about that personal kind of experience and how it led you to write the kind of book that you did.
Well, to be honest with you, I was writing a book before the reaction took place. But at the same time, you know, the fact that my son is growing up in a society where, you know, with some regularity, you can cut on the TV and see some video of a black person either being choked or beaten or shot. We have to prepare our kids for that world. The black world is so much more violent than other people's worlds in this country. And part of the book, certainly, is about preparing your children to live in that world.
He is growing up in a world where now there is more and more attention being paid to that. It's become, as you indicated, very public. It's all over the news. There's an association of sheriffs, police chiefs, and prosecutors who are going to the White House and talking about getting rid of mandatory minimums and other kinds of things that work to the disadvantage of black people in this country. Are those good signs?
Sure they are. Sure they are. Yeah, they definitely are. I mean, they certainly are better than the kind of signs we were seeing 25 years ago when folks were calling for more mandatory minimums and longer sentences. The problem, of course, is that we have wreaked havoc on a whole community. The incarceration rate in this country in 1970 was about 150 per 100,000, somewhere between 100 and 200 per 100,000, pretty much in line with the rest of the Western world. The incarceration rate right now is 700 per 100,000. For African American men, the rate is 4,000 per 100,000, way, way beyond anything that, you know, we've seen. And so the notion that this can, you know, be easily, you know, drawn back, that we can easily somehow go back to the somewhat civilized system, not totally, but the somewhat civilized system we had in 1970, just by saying a few kind words at the White House is wrong. I would expect us to struggle with this for the next few generations. I don't think this will be as easy to repair as many people think.
Describe your own growing up in Baltimore.
Well, I grew up in West Baltimore. I had two very, very loving parents, a mother and a father. I had six brothers and sisters. My dad is sired by other women. One of my brothers, we have the same mother, but the others I do not. I was raised in very, very close contact with my brothers and sisters. We were all, you know, very, very tight. Love them, adore them. My parents worked very, very hard to make sure that I was educated, to make sure I was as protected as I possibly could be. And yet when I went outside, there was always this dissonance between what was happening in my home and what was happening in the neighborhood, which is something your parents can't really protect you from. And for much of my childhood, I wondered why that was. You know, how could it be that my family, my parents, relatively pretty well educated, professionals with jobs, why did we live in a community where I spent good parts, you know, of my time thinking about how to protect myself?
How much involvement did you have specifically and personally with violence?
A lot. A ton. By the time I, you know, came, I mean, the book, you know, very, very early in the book, I talk about being 11 years old and seeing a child, pull out a gun on another child. When I was in middle school, and less so in high school, but certainly was present in high school, I constantly thought about, you know, what, you know, violence some other kid might do to me. That was like a constant threat. And again, at that point in time, I couldn't understand why that was the case. You know, why was it that everybody I knew had been jumped on by like five other kids, you know, and you know, beaten down? Why did that happen so much? And it was only later that I was able to perceive that this neighborhood I lived in, you know, had been part of had been made in a certain way. That Baltimore was in fact segregated. And by segregated, I don't mean simply not living around white people, but had been cordoned off. And resources had not been invested in the way they had been invested in other neighborhoods. Resources, in fact, had been extracted out of the neighborhood in a way that they weren't extracted out of other neighborhoods. And we were left there to pretty much fend for ourselves. When you have plundered people, when you have fenced off people living in a country that exalts wealth and the good life, some amount of frustration attends that condition and always, you know, some amount of violence, too.
Tell us a bit about your friend from Howard University, who was killed by a police officer, and why that is so important and why it represents so much of your analysis of what's going on in America.
Prince Jones went to Howard University with me. He's a sterling young man. His mother, Mabel Jones, was raised in Opelousas, Louisiana, a child of sharecroppers who had, you know, worked her way up to become a doctor. She served in the United States Navy also. She raised her son, you know, on the values that, you know, you hear so much about in Black America, about being twice as good. That was who Prince Jones was. In 2000, he was trailed by a police officer from the suburbs of Maryland through the District of Columbia into Maryland, where he was shot and killed mere yards from his fiance's home. This happened roughly a month after my own son was born, and it just horrified me. It absolutely, absolutely horrified me. And the notion that, you know, someone, you know, who was involved in no illegal activity, but just because they were associated with another group of people could be trailed in that sort of way and killed, that the officer would not be held accountable for that killing. The police department really would not be held accountable for that killing, that the officer could go out, you know, and just, you know, work as though nothing had happened, that there would be no criminal charges, absolutely horrified me.
The officer involved was Black, so was the county government, Prince George's County in Maryland, where he came from. What's the significance of that?
There is no significance to it. It only has significance if you believe racism to be a matter of bad and evil individuals. But if you understand it as it actually functions in American society, as systemic, as a set of policies, as done things, a policy that, you know, says that, you know, it's okay for me to track you, you know, across three municipalities, a policy that, you know, has generated a kind of fear that says black folks who look a certain way, black men of a certain age can be regarded as criminals, that there's no reason for black individuals to be immune to that sort of thinking. There's no reason for them to you know, especially, you know, when they serve, you know, as officers of the law. There's no reason why they might be any different. A white officer could have followed them and made a totally different decision, depending on the person. The question is the system. The question is not the individual people.
Tell us what the mother of your friend had to say after her son was killed in the way that you described and how she views the future.
Well, I saw her. I interviewed her before this book, and it had been almost 15 years since he'd been killed, and she was still carrying the weight of it, and is still carrying the weight of it. You never get over something like that. She was deeply pessimistic about the future of the country, and that was heartbreaking to see.
You said a moment ago that you think it's going to be generations before there's real change in this
if
country.
If there's real change at all.
If there's change.
If there's to be changed, though, it is the work of generations, I believe that.
But you tell your son at the end of the book to keep up with the struggle. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, he has to struggle. He has to struggle. No matter whether it's going to be, you know, the work of generations to, you know, get this fixed, provided we do get it fixed, that's true of every fight. You know, most people who struggle do not get to see the fruits of their labor in their lifetime. Slavery went on, enslavement went on in this country for 250 years. Which means there were generations of black people born into this country who looked into the past and only saw enslaved black people, and looked into the future and only saw enslaved black people. And yet they struggled on. You know, I tell people one of my journalistic heroes is Ida B. Wells, who dedicated her life to the fight against lynching. She wanted to see the Senate pass an anti-lynching bill. She wanted policy. No such policy was forthcoming in her lifetime. The Senate didn't even apologize until some 70 years after she was dead, and lynching continued. She struggled. What right do you have to not struggle?
The book is called Between the World and Me. The author is Ta-Nehisi Coates. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.